Only if I was spotted, he said defensively. Will finally lost his temper. We spotted you, he shouted. You're not terribly difficult to spot. You go blundering about the countryside in your fine clothing, on your fine horse, for all to see. What makes you think Lassany and his men would be any less observant? Before Egan could answer, he continued, And do you realize that if they did notice you following us, it would draw attention to us and ruin our mission? Egan jutted his bottom lip unhappily.
I suppose so,
he agreed. Oh, you do. How good of you, you great blundering idiot. Go back to Prince Louis and tell him you were recognized. Tell him you could have jeopardized our mission and his nephew's life. Tell him if he sends someone else, anyone else, to keep an eye on us, I'll put an arrow in him, and I'll put one in you if I see you again. Then I'll abandon this mission and return to Araluen, and he can explain it all to King Philippe. Egan said nothing. He stood, hanging his head in embarrassment and fear. Will raised the bow once more. Toss down your sword, he ordered. Egan's hand went instinctively to the sword at his waist. It was a fine weapon, the hilt decorated with gold wire and a large ruby pommel.
My sword?
Will motioned with the arrow. Get rid of it, and the dagger. Egan was carrying a matching dagger in a sheath on the opposite side of his belt. Reluctantly, under the threat of the arrow knocked on Will's bow, he drew both weapons and let them fall to the road. Now get going, Will ordered. The man gestured uncertainly at his weapons, lying at his feet. But go, Will shouted. Go back to Chateau La Lumière and tell your prince that you are an incapable idiot. Head down, Egan began trudging back down the road, walking awkwardly in his high riding boots. Will watched him go, then stooped and picked up the sword and the dagger. He glanced at them once, then tossed them far into the forest beside the road. He glanced up, caught Maddie's amused gaze and shook his head. What a family, he said in disgust. 24. They saw no further sign of Egan. The following day, Will saddled Tug and rode back along their tracks to make sure he was no longer following. Satisfied that their would-be shadow had left, he returned to the cart, and they continued on their way. The high road, the most direct route to Falaise, cut across a wide, looping river at two points. In doing so, it travelled virtually due north. To the west, a range of low mountains, steep and rocky, provided a barrier to travel. A narrow mountain track ran across the range, but it would necessitate a long detour to reach Falaise that way. The main road was more direct and more easily travelled, in spite of the fact that it necessitated crossing the river, La Rivière Signe, in two places, once by way of a ford and the second time via a bridge. Will indicated the ford on the map Philippe had provided. We should reach the ford in a few hours, he said. Pity there's no bridge there. I guess we'll get our feet wet. Maddie leaned forward from under the canopy that covered the driving seat of the cart and surveyed the sky. There were dark clouds on the eastern horizon, and a strong wind was pushing them westward. We may get more than our feet wet, she said. There's rain in those clouds. Will glanced up at them. We should be all right, he said. A little rain won't hurt us. As it turned out, the clouds contained more than a little rain. They pulled off the road late in the afternoon, with the ford still nowhere in sight. Will had hoped to cross before dark, but the scale of the map wasn't accurate, and the distance to the river was apparently much greater than it indicated. "Why am I not surprised by that?" he asked. For a few minutes, he debated pushing on, but he didn't want to risk crossing an unknown ford in the dark. They set up their camp. It was Maddie's turn to cook, and she quickly built a fire, setting four plump pigeons on green sticks to roast over the flames, moving them closer as the fire died down to red-hot coals. Fat sizzled and spat from the grilling birds, and a delicious scent filled the air. She set a pot to boil with quartered potatoes in salted water, and tore up some greens they'd been supplied by the castle kitchen before they left. These, with an oil and lemon juice dressing, would make a fresh-tasting salad. Will watched her work and smiled. "I've taught you well," he said. It was a matter of some pride among the rangers that they could all cook nourishing, tasty meals over a campfire, and Will and Holt were two of the best camp cooks in the Corps. Knowing this, Maddie was quietly pleased at Will's words of praise. The trees around their small campsite were swaying more and more as the wind freshened, seeming to be almost alive as they moved from side to side in a stately unison. They grew close together, and the branches and trunks groaned as they rubbed against each other with the movement. Maddie looked up at the sky, where roiling clouds were quickly blanking out the stars. "That rain's not too far off," she said. Will studied the sky as well. The wind was strengthening with each moment, and he could smell the rain in it. He rose from his comfortable spot in front of the fire. "I'll get the rain blankets on Tug and Bumper," he said. The rain blankets were waterproof tarpaulins, lined with woolen material, that went over the little horses' backs and kept them warm and dry in bad weather. Of course, they could manage quite well with their natural coats, but there was no sense in making them suffer discomfort if it could be avoided. With their heightened senses, the horses could smell the coming rain as well, and they submitted readily to having the blankets put in place. Even Bumper, who was inclined to turn such an exercise into a game, only dodged and skipped away two or three times before standing, head lowered, while Will slipped the cover over his head and strapped it under his belly. They ate quickly. While Will was boiling a pan of water to clean the platters, the first big raindrops began to hammer down. Then a spear of lightning split the sky, and a massive reverberation of thunder boomed out. A second later, the rain hit them, driven by a sudden ferocious wind, and sheeting down on the campsite. "We'll leave these for the morning," Will said, dumping their platters and spoons in the boiling water, and leaving the pan over the fire. It would be extinguished within a few minutes, he knew. Maddie quickly packed up the cooking utensils, seized the coffee pot, half full of fresh coffee, and their mugs, and clambered into the back of the cart, where the rain was drumming down on the canvas roof. Will led the two horses round to the lee side of the cart, where it would shield them from the worst of the wind and rain. They nosed up against it, grumbling and nickering. Then Will clambered into the cart as well. Normally, when they camped, he rolled his bedding out on the grass under the cart. Tonight, the ground there was already centimetres deep in rain. There was another vicious crack, and lightning flared, lighting the sky around them. Will made himself comfortable in the cart. It was cramped, but not unbearably so. Maddie passed him a mug of coffee, and he sipped at it gratefully. In the few minutes it had taken him to organise the horses, he had been quite drenched, and the hot drink was most welcome. It was the mother of all storms. The cart shuddered with the constant booming of thunder and fierce wind and rain that slammed into it, the wind driving the rain almost horizontally in solid sheets of water. The lightning was vicious and intense. Each jagged fork lit up the interior of the cart, so that the canvas roof showed bright white, with the dark outline of the frame seared across it. The image was left burned onto their vision for several seconds after the light had faded. Maddie felt Bumper shoving his muzzle against the canvas close by her. She wriggled her hand under the point where the canvas hood met the timber side of the cart, and stroked his velvety nose with her fingertips. "Nothing to worry about, boy. Just a little thunder and lightning," she crooned softly. "He's frightened of storms?" Will asked. She shook her head. "Not frightened. He doesn't like the sudden noises and flashing of lights. He's okay if he knows I'm close by." The end of her sleeve was soaked with the icy rain, and she withdrew her hand, tucking it under her blanket and pulling the warm, soft wool up to her chin. She quite enjoyed sleeping while it rained. Even when it was a savage storm like this one, she felt warm and safe under her blanket, and the noise and flaring lightning only added to the sensation of being dry and secure in the cart. Then a trickle of water found its way through a seam in the canvas cover and ran down into her ear, and the spell was broken. The storm gradually rolled over them and over the mountains to the west. The rain persisted, as did the wind, for a few hours more. Around 4 in the morning, it died away to a gentle patter. An hour before daybreak, something woke her. She lay in her warm blanket for a few seconds, wondering what it had been. Then she realized. The rain had stopped. The sun rose on a bright, clear day, with not a breath of wind. 25. Will awoke, stiff and cramped. The cart was small, and with Maddie's target wheel and their other paraphernalia packed inside, the space left for sleeping was cramped. Maddie, of course, had her usual sleeping space where she could stretch out comfortably. But Will had been confined between the target wheel and the side of the cart, and had lain awkwardly. When he awoke, his back ached and his neck was stiff. He stretched and groaned. His neck would be stiff for some hours, he knew. Still, there was nothing for it. If he hadn't slept in the cart, he would have been drenched. He untied the flap at the back of the cart and peered out. The sky was blue, with a few puffs of white cloud sliding slowly across it. A far cry from the brutal weather the night before. "You'd think butter wouldn't melt in its mouth," he said to himself. He swung his legs over the tailgate of the cart and dropped lightly to the ground, right into a shin-deep puddle of rainwater that lay there. He cursed quietly and picked his way to a dry piece of ground. Inside the cart, Maddie laughed, guessing what had happened. "You said we'd be getting our feet wet," she said, reminding him of his prediction of what would happen at the ford. As her comment brought that thought to his mind, a worried frown crossed his face. He looked up and down the road, and at the cleared space to either side. Vast sheets of rainwater lay everywhere, pooled in the depressions in the roadway and the soft ground to either side. There had been so much rain the night before that it had been unable to drain away. "We may have a problem," he said. He moved around to the side of the cart where Tug and Bumper were still standing. They had found a slightly higher patch of ground where the rain hadn't collected. They nickered good-naturedly to him as he unstrapped the tarpaulin blankets and laid them over the shafts at the front of the cart to dry. The two horses wandered a few paces, looking for fresh grass to crop, and bending their necks to drink at some of the deeper puddles. He He walked back to the rear of the cart, looking for a dry approach, but there was none, and he shrugged fatalistically. His feet and leggings were soaked now anyway. He waded through the rainwater and pulled the canvas flap aside. Their saddles and tack were stacked on the left-hand side of the cart. He took his saddle, saddle blanket, and bridle, and backed away. Maddie watched him going and scrambled to the back of the cart, finally forsaking the warmth of her blankets. "Going somewhere?" she asked, as he moved to a dry patch of ground and whistled for Tug to join him. "I'm going to take a look at that ford," he said, as he quickly saddled Tug. "All that rain last night could mean it's not there any more." She frowned. That thought hadn't occurred to her. "What do we do if it's flooded?" He nodded towards the mountains looming above them in the west. "According to the map, there's a track across the mountains. It's a long way around, but we may have to go that way." He swung up into the saddle and wheeled Tug toward the roadway. Maddie watched as they cantered off, splashing through the pooled water on the road. Will called back to her. "You can get breakfast ready while I'm gone." Holding Tug to a steady canter, and without the cart to slow them down, he reached the ford in 15 minutes. He brought Tug to a halt on the high ground of the bank, before it sloped down to the river's surface, where the ford should have been. "Damn," he said quietly to himself. Tug's ears pricked at the sound of his voice. "Are you talking to me?" he sighed. "Not really, just annoyed. We should have crossed last night." He took the map from under his jerkin and unfolded it, studying the notations at the site of the ford. They indicated that the river at this point was 50 meters wide and 1 meter deep, easily passable for the cart and the 2 horses. What he now saw was something entirely different. The ford, as such, had simply disappeared, obliterated by the surging waters that flooded the riverbed. The crossing was now at least 150 meters wide, and while the first few meters might be 1 meter deep, it rapidly dropped away, so that there was no sign of the riverbed beneath the brown, surging waters. Clicking his tongue, he urged Tug down the bank and into the edge of the water. He was instantly aware, as the sturdy little horse arranged his footing and set himself more securely, of the power of the running current. He glanced down to where the water was lapping against Tug's belly and could see the water piling up against his upstream legs. Tug snorted as Will urged him forward. He stepped carefully, feeling out the uneven bottom, scoured into a series of ridges and channels by the fast-running water as he went. Within a few paces, the water was up to his shoulders, well over the indicated depth of 1 meter, and with each pace, it rose higher. And the far bank was still at least 140 meters away. "We'll never do it," Will said bitterly. "I could make it, even if I have to swim. Bumper too." "Not with the cart," Will said, "and we can't leave that behind." Tug's ears twitched and he shook his mane. He hadn't thought of that. Wary of the fierce current battering against his horse, Will carefully turned him around and rode back out of the river. On dry land once more, Tug paused to shake himself, sending a brilliant fan of silver spray in all directions. Will turned back in the saddle to study the river. Of course, the water would recede in 1 or 2 days, and the ford would be passable again. But that left the bridge farther along. Chances were, with flooding as violent as this, it could have been swept away, and that couldn't be rectified in 1 or 2 days. "We're going to have to take the mountain road," Will said, and he urged Tug into a canter back toward their campsite. aware that the mountain track would take a lot longer to negotiate, he was tempted to set the little horse to a gallop, but he desisted. It would only save him 5 or 10 minutes at the most, and Tug was going to need all his strength for the mountain track. The track was a nightmare. In fine weather, it would have been difficult, but after the heavy rain, it was a mass of slippery, steep, and unstable mud that wound its way up the side of the mountains. Will and Maddie dismounted from the cart and took it in turns, leading the horses as they struggled up the path, pulling the cart behind them. Their usual practice had been to let each horse pull the cart for an hour, changing them over at the end of that time. Now Will reduced that to 30 minutes, keeping a watchful eye on the willing little beasts as they fought their way upward in the gluey, uneven mud. At the end of each half-hour shift, he praised and patted the horses as he unharnessed them. They were amazing animals, he thought, willing to give their all for their masters, never flinching or refusing or backing off from the task in hand. They simply put their shaggy heads down, braced themselves, and heaved against the harness as they dragged the cart up the winding steep path. At times, the track was so steep and slippery that Will and Maddie had to lend a hand, putting their shoulders against the rear wheels or the back tray of the cart, and heaving and shoving while whichever horse was in the harness pulled. On one occasion, when Bumper was harnessed, they even had to rope Tug to the cart for extra purchase. Such was the training and dedication of the ranger horses that Tug needed no urging or driving. Sensing what had to be done, he added his considerable strength to the task. Finally, after hours of hauling and heaving and shoving, covered in mud and panting heavily, they reached the top. The mountain here widened into a large plateau, where the descent was more gradual. The track led them across the plateau, angling north, then northeast, as it slowly descended by gentle stages to the plain below. They could see the river curving away beneath them, and at one point Maddie plucked at Will's sleeve and pointed. Following the direction she indicated, he could make out the wreckage of the bridge. "Even if we'd got across the ford, we'd never have made it past there," she said. Will grunted in reply. His concern that the bridge might have been washed away was proven correct. That was some consolation, even though the mountain track had added kilometres to the distance they would have to travel. Halfway down to the plain, he saw smoke rising from among a grove of trees. He checked the map once more and pointed it out to Maddie. "There's a village there called Entente," he said. "The map says there's an inn. We might stop and clean up a little and give the horses a break." "That sounds agreeable," Maddie said, and he looked suspiciously at her, wondering if she had just made an outrageous pun. She returned his look with such an air of innocence that he was sure she had. Mud-spattered and bone-weary, they rode into the village, a collection of around 20 buildings. They were mostly residences, although there was the usual selection of commercial businesses, a mill, a tannery, and a smithy among them. And there was the inn. It was the largest building in the village, and it was set at the far end as they rode in. It was the only two-story building, and it had the usual open space with tables and benches under an awning outside the main entrance, where customers could relax and eat and drink in fine weather. Not that there'd been too much of that lately, Will told himself, noting the preponderance of deep puddles along the road surface, and in the stamped-down fine gravel that covered the open space outside the inn. He brought their distinctive cart to a halt outside the inn. A second or so later, The door opened and a man emerged, wiping his hands on a long apron tied around his waist, the standard badge of office of an innkeeper.
"Good afternoon," he said cheerfully. "Always glad to see Jongleuse passing through. Were you planning to entertain us tonight?"
Will grimaced. He was weary and muddy, and didn't feel like performing after their difficult day on the road.
"I was planning more on a bath and a soft bed," he said. "It's been a difficult day."
The innkeeper nodded shrewdly. He gazed back down the road that had brought them here.
"Came up the mountain, did you?" he asked.
"That we did. The ford at the River Signe is washed out, and the bridge is washed away too."
"That would happen after that storm last night,"
the innkeeper averred. He paused, then went on in a persuasive tone.
"Still, if you'd agree to entertain the customers tonight, that hot bath and soft bed would be on the house."
Will considered the offer for a few seconds. His neck was still stiff after sleeping in the cramped interior of the cart the night before. The temptation to stretch out in a real bed and the luxury of a hot bath was too strong to resist.
"You've just about talked me into it," he said. "If there was a pot of good coffee included..."
He let the sentence hang, and the innkeeper smiled.
"Of course, you can leave your wagon there. It'll let people know you're in town."
He indicated a side alley.
"There's a stable behind the inn. You can put your horses in there. I'll get one of the girls to start heating water for the bath. The bathhouse is in the back as well."
Will clambered down wearily and began unharnessing Bumper, whose turn it was between the shafts.
"I'll take the first bath," he told Maddie.
"I expected no less," she replied, smiling. 26. The steaming hot bath, followed by 30 minutes real sleep in a proper bed, did wonders for Will's sense of well-being. There was only a vague memory of his stiff neck remaining as he washed out his mud-spattered clothes, ran them through a mangle, then spread them on a line in the stable yard to dry. He and Maddie ate an early supper, a fragrant vegetable stew with fresh, crusty bread and a jug of excellent coffee sweetened, as was their habit, with honey. The innkeeper eyed them curiously as they stirred the honey into the coffee.
"Can't say I've seen that done before," he said.
Will gestured to the coffee jug and honey pot. "Try it," he said, and the innkeeper complied. His face lit up with a gratified smile as he tasted the fragrant, sweet brew, and he quickly took another sip.
"Excellent," he said. "I'll be recommending that to my customers from now on."
"And charging them for the honey, I imagine," Will said. The man grinned.
"Of course. Have you been in the innkeeping trade, then?"
Will shook his head.
"No, just a lot of inns. Never knew an innkeeper who didn't know how to squeeze a few extra coins out of his customers."
He said it in a light-hearted tone, and the innkeeper took no offence. Rather, he saw it as a compliment of sorts. He offered his hand.
"My name's Michel Dumont, by the way."
Drawn by the cart parked in front of the tavern, customers began arriving and filling the tables. As they ordered food and drink, sending the two serving girls scurrying back and forth from the kitchen to the tap room, Michel viewed the busy scene with a smile.
"Good business for early in the week," he said, then stopped Giselle, the prettiest of the two serving girls, as she hurried past with a jug of coffee for one of the tables.
"Don't forget to serve them a pot of honey with that," he said.
He had already told the girls about Will and Maddie's innovation. Will waited until most of the crowd had finished eating.
Then he uncased his mandola and made a few adjustments to the tuning. An expectant buzz ran round the room, and he affected not to notice that all eyes were on him. Finished tuning, he began to put the mandola away. A small cry of protest came from the middle of the crowd, and he turned, pretending to be surprised as he saw the room full of people watching him. "Oh," he smiled, "did you want to hear a song?" There was a chorus of assent from the room, and a few hand claps. He slung the mandola over his shoulder and launched into a bouncy, light-hearted version of Sunshine Lady. It was one of his favourites, a popular folk tune about a red-headed girl with sunshine in her hair and happiness in her eyes. Few audiences could resist joining in, and this one was no exception. The room echoed to the sound of eager, if occasionally tuneless, voices singing along, while several dozen pairs of hands clapped in time. In remote, sleepy villages like this one, it was relatively easy for a good jongler, and Will was definitely a good one, to involve and excite the audience. Their lives were a repetitive sequence of work, eat, sleep, and work again. The work was hard, and there was little to divert them as the days and months passed and the seasons rolled around in a predictable and inevitable sequence. Added to that, there was a certain glamour in Will and Maddie being foreigners, and Will salted his performance with tales of events and misadventures in exotic locations. Not all of them were strictly true, of course, but all of them were highly entertaining. As Will neared the end of his set of songs, Maddie took the large sack around among the tables and held it out while coins clinked into it. Within a few minutes, it had grown agreeably heavy. Satisfied that she hadn't missed anyone, she hurried outside and deposited the coins in the locked strongbox at the rear of the cart, snapping the heavy padlock back in place once she had done so. There was a lot of money in there by now, she noticed with some satisfaction. Inside the tavern, Will was already announcing her act, billing her tonight as the Mistress of the Flashing Blades of Peril. She wondered idly when he would run out of hyperbolic ways of describing her to audiences. As two of the stable hands lifted the target wheel out of the cart and set it up, and the audience started pouring out of the tavern to the tables and chairs in the square outside, she fetched her knives and began her act. It went well, very well indeed. To her surprise and gratification, she finally convinced an audience member to be strapped onto the target board, the Wheel of a Thousand Deaths, as Will described it this night. The person in question was the village blacksmith, the strapping young man named Simon, who had his eye on Giselle, the serving maid, and was eager to impress her with his courage and bravado. The bravado faded somewhat as the wheel began to turn, and he saw Maddie preparing to throw the first knife. As it thudded into the wood beside his head, he let out a startled, "Eek!" It was such an unlikely sound from such a big, muscular fellow that the audience broke out in peals of laughter, which became more infectious as each successive knife was greeted by the same high-pitched squeak of fright. It made a superb climax to Maddie's act. She almost wished she could offer Simon a permanent job travelling with them as her target. As the wheel came to a halt, she skipped forward to help Will unstrap the blacksmith, kissing him on the cheek as he stepped down, his legs a little unsteady. She glanced around for Giselle and saw the girl was pointedly ignoring the young man, going to great lengths to look unimpressed, which told Maddie that she was very impressed indeed. As coins showered around Maddie, thrown by the laughing patrons, she took Simon's hand and held it high. "Please, ladies and gentlemen, Show your generosity for a courageous young man. Let's have some coins for Simon.
But as the coins began to shower down once more, a voice from the back of the crowd interrupted.
And let's have some coins for the black vultures.
An ominous silence fell over the crowd as the speaker strode forward into the light. He was a man of average height and build, with long black hair tied in a queue at the back of his head. He had a full beard, and above it, a hawk-like beak of a nose, surmounted by dark eyes, set close together. A horizontal scar ran across his forehead. He wore a ragged black jerkin and leggings, and a short black cape that reached to his waist. And he carried a loaded crossbow, resting in the crook of his arm. The silence that had fallen over the crowd was replaced by a low hum of recognition. As the man stepped farther into the light, Will became aware of movement at other points around the fringe of the crowd. Seven more men, similarly dressed and armed with a variety of clubs, axes and short swords, moved out of the shadows, where they had been watching the performance. The leader nodded at Simon, who was still swaying uncertainly. He hadn't yet recovered his balance from the time he had spent on the rotating target wheel.
You, start picking up those coins and bring them to me.
But Simon, aware that Giselle was watching the confrontation, squared his shoulders and snarled in reply.
The blazes I will. You can...
He got no further. The bandit leader stepped in close to him and swung the butt of the crossbow so that it slammed into Simon's forehead. The blacksmith staggered and fell, hitting the gravel with a heavy thump. His head bounced off the hard ground, and he lay stunned. Maddie ducked involuntarily. The heavy impact could well have triggered the crossbow, she knew, sending the wicked-looking bolt who knew where. As she regained her composure, a figure darted across the square and fell to her knees beside Simon, cradling his head in her arms. It was Giselle. Blood ran freely down the blacksmith's face from a deep cut above his eye. She mopped at it gently with her apron. His eye drawn by Maddie's involuntary movement, the bandit chief now pointed at her.
You, girl, you fetch me those coins.
Maddie hesitated, ready to defy him. Her blood was up, and she was angered by the cruel and unexpected attack on the young blacksmith. But Will touched her arm and said quietly, "Better do as he says. This isn't the time." She took a deep breath, gaining control of her anger, as she realized Will was right. They were unarmed, facing a group of eight armed men. Men who were obviously ready to use their weapons without further warning. The villagers couldn't be relied on for help. They were cowed by the dark-clad intruders. She couldn't blame them. They were farm folk. They were unarmed as well, and unaccustomed to fighting. She took the money sack from inside her jerkin and began to move around the open space of the square, collecting the money strewn there, and dropping it into the sack. She moved past the sobbing Giselle. Simon was beginning to regain consciousness, groaning softly, and moving his head from side to side. More coins went into the sack, and she moved to collect another pile that had rolled farther than the rest. Moving casually, bent over to retrieve the coins, she edged closer to the target wheel, where her five knives were buried point first in the soft wood. She studiously avoided looking at the wheel as she moved closer and closer.
"Not another step!"
The harsh voice stopped her in mid-stride. The target wheel was only 2 meters away, and she looked up to see the gang leader had the crossbow trained directly at her, held at waist height.
"Get away from that!"
the man ordered, jerking the crossbow to one side to emphasize the order. Reluctantly, she backed away from the target wheel, standing in a half crouch.
Now move among the tables for more donations, he said, smiling sardonically.
Then he addressed the people at the tables as Maddie approached them. And I advise you to be generous, ladies and gentlemen.
Michelle, the publican, stepped forward now to plead on behalf of his customers.
Please, Vincent, these people aren't wealthy. They're poor farmers, and they've already given plenty.
He indicated the ground where Maddie had collected the money thrown by the audience.
Vincent, the bandit said.
So you know my name, do you?
Michel shrugged and lowered his eyes.
Everyone knows the leader of the Black Vultures, he said, hoping that an ingratiating manner might mollify the bandit and convince him to show a little mercy.
But the ruse, transparent as it was, didn't work. The bandit's eyes flashed with anger.
Then you should know that you address me as Monsieur Vincent, he snarled.
Then he jerked his head at Maddie, who had stopped when Michel intervened on behalf of the villagers.
Keep going, he ordered,
and she held out the sack to the nearest table of customers, feeling it twitch as the coins clinked into it.
As she threaded her way among the tables, Vincent called out a further warning.
Don't hold back. I'll be searching a few of you when we're finished, and if I find you've kept anything back, it'll go badly for you.
Finally, she collected the last of the coins from the villagers. The sack now held a considerable weight of money. She took it to Vincent and dropped it onto the table beside him, where it gave off a pleasing chink. He nodded, then gestured toward the cart.
I'll have the cash box from the cart as well, he said.
Maddie's heart sank as she realized he must have been watching her for some time, and had seen her deposit the takings into the cash box earlier in the evening.
Please, sir.
Will stepped forward a pace, then stopped abruptly as the crossbow swung toward his stomach.
We've been working and travelling all week for that money.
Vincent smiled cruelly.
Then there should be plenty in it, he said.
He jerked his head toward the cart and ordered Maddie.
Go. Get it.
Sir, I beg of you, Will pleaded. That's all our money in the world. Leave us something.
Beneath the pleading, he wanted nothing more than to smash the superior grin off the bandit's face. But he knew it would be more in the character of a travelling jongler if he seemed to beg.
I suppose you're right. I shouldn't take it all, Vincent said.
His eyes fixed on the pleading jongler, Vincent reached into the sack on the table. Working by feel, he selected the smallest coin he could find and flicked it into the dust at Will's feet.
Now, get that cash box, he told Maddie.
27.
It's my fault, said the innkeeper the following morning. I should have known they were back in the area.
Who are they? Will asked, harnessing Tug between the shafts of the cart as they prepared to be on their way.
They call themselves the Black Vultures, Michel told him. They've been preying on the farms and villages in this area for the past 2 years. I thought they'd gone south, or I would have warned you to keep your money hidden somewhere safe.
Could have used a warning, said Will, but without any sense of recrimination.
He got all our savings, and we'd worked hard for them.
We'll be on short commons for a while now.
Michel shrugged.
I'd help out if I could, he said, but he cleaned me out too.
Will glanced quickly at him.
He doubted that last statement. Innkeepers were experts at keeping their takings safe from marauding bandits.
Inns were a prime target, after all.
Vincent and his thugs may have taken some of Michel's cash,
but Will was sure there was a lot more hidden somewhere, probably buried in the woods or under the flagstones of the bathhouse. Still, it wasn't Michelle's responsibility to recompense them. Will snorted derisively now as he thought about the gang's name. "Black Vultures," he said. "Why do these ragged bandits always give themselves such fierce-sounding names? Black Vultures. Bear Killers. Why don't they call themselves the Turtle Doves or the Puddle Ducks?" Michelle looked at him curiously. "Who are the Bear Killers?" he asked. Will shrugged dismissively. "They were a bunch of thugs we ran into in Araluin," he said. He glanced up as Maddie emerged from the inn, carrying their luggage. "Load that into the cart and we'll be away," he told her. Maddie nodded and glanced at Michelle. "How's Simon this morning?" she asked. "He has an aching head," Michelle told her. Then he added with a smile, "But Giselle is looking after him, so he probably thinks it's worth it." "Give him my thanks for his help last night," she said, and he nodded. Will finished buckling the harness around Tug's stout body, tugged at it once or twice to test the tension, then clambered up onto the driver's seat. Bumper was tethered to the rear of the cart, although that was only for appearance's sake. As a ranger horse, he would follow wherever they went without the need for a lead rein. "We'll be off then," Will said, as Maddie climbed up beside him. "Thanks for your hospitality." Michelle spread his hands in a helpless, unhappy gesture. "Sorry about the way things turned out," he said. "Not your fault," Will told him. Then, as an afterthought, he said, "By the way, any idea where those thugs might be? I wouldn't want to run into them again." Michelle paused uncertainly, looking up and down the road that ran through the village. "If they run true to form, they'll have a camp somewhere in the forest, but they'll stay away from the main road. You'll see a fork in the road about half a kilometre out of town. The right fork leads into the forest proper. I'd wager they'll be somewhere there, but you'd be wise to avoid them, as you say." Will raised a hand in thanks, then clicked his tongue at Tug. The little horse leaned forward into the traces, and the cart moved off at a brisk walking pace. They sat in silence for some minutes. They reached the fork in the road that Michelle had mentioned. Will brought Tug to a halt. He looped the reins over the brake handle and climbed down, gesturing for Maddie to follow him. "Let's take a look around," he said. He was stooping, his eyes studying the surface of the road, still soft after the recent rain. After a few moments, he dropped to one knee and studied the road surface more closely. In a muddy patch where a puddle had dried only recently, he saw two distinct footprints. They were clearly delineated, which told him they were relatively new. They hadn't had a chance to deteriorate and lose definition. Maddie, a few metres farther away, also dropped to one knee. She was looking at a patch of damp ground that spread from one side of the track to the other. "Tracks here," she said. She traced the marks in the clay with one forefinger. "At least half a dozen men. I'd say it's our friends, the Black Vultures." "That's what I thought," Will said, straightening and looking off down the narrow road in the direction the tracks were leading. "I take it we don't plan on avoiding Vincent and his cronies," Maddie said, with a half-smile on her face. Will shook his head. There was no answering sign of amusement in his expression. It was grim and determined. "Not in the slightest," he told her. "I don't like being robbed, and I don't like bandits who prey on defenceless villagers." He took hold of Tug's harness and led the little horse into a small clearing 5 meters off the road. He unharnessed Tug, then retrieved their saddles and bridles from the cart. Maddie joined him, and they quickly saddled the two horses. Tug and Bumper shook themselves, pleased at the prospect of becoming saddle horses again. Pulling a cart was demeaning work after all. Maddie grinned at Bumper and rubbed his soft nose affectionately. "Happy now?" she asked, and he shook his mane at her. "Time we changed too," Will said. They exchanged their gaudy jongler's outfits for their drab grey, brown and green ranger uniforms. Their weapons were in a concealed compartment under the tray of the cart. They strung their bows, hooked their quivers to their belts, and buckled on their double scabbards. Maddie also had her sling wound loosely beside the hilt of her sax, and she took a small but heavy chamois shot bag and hooked it onto the knife belt opposite the two knives. Last of all, they slung their green and grey mottled cloaks around their shoulders and pulled up the cowls, so their faces were in deep shadow. In less than 5 minutes, the brightly coloured, flamboyantly dressed jonglers had transformed themselves into two heavily armed, grim figures, who merged into the dark tones of the forest background. "I know just how Bumper feels," Maddie said, a satisfied note in her voice. Being a jongler was all very well, but it was good to be back as a ranger, she thought. The trail left by the black vultures was easy to follow, particularly for two such skilled trackers. The road surface was soft clay and sand, and the recent rain had left a lot of water lying in puddles. The boots of the eight bandits had left deep, clear impressions, particularly as the bandits tended to walk on the side of the road where most of the water gathered. Maddie queried this, and Will explained. "Makes it easier for them to take cover in the forest if they're pursued, or if they see a traveller coming toward them and decide to ambush him." By contrast, the two rangers rode down the centre of the road, where the slight camber meant the surface was drier, as the rain drained off to the edges. That way, they left minimum sign of their passing. It was a habit deeply ingrained in them by years of practice and experience. Rangers, expert trackers that they were, left little sign for others to track them. By the same token, they didn't ride side by side. They were stalking a dangerous foe, and while Will led the way, keeping an eye on the tracks left by the Black Vulture gang, Maddie stayed back 30 to 40 meters, ready to support Will if there was any sign of an attack from the trees beside the road. They had been on the side road for 2 hours when Will drew rein and gestured for Maddie to catch up. She rode alongside him and stopped as he pointed to a faint track leading off into the trees. It was barely discernible. Most people would probably have overlooked it, but Will wasn't most people, and he'd seen that the jumble of boot prints they had been following went no farther down the road. "They left the road here," he told her in a quiet voice. "I'd say we're getting close to their camp." He dismounted and followed the narrow trail through the trees for a few meters. Then he stopped and pointed to the ground, where a small puddle of water had formed in an irregularity in the forest floor. On the edge of the puddle, there was a clear imprint of a boot. He beckoned to Maddie to join him. "We'll leave the horses here," he told her, "and follow this trail. Keep your eyes and ears open. Vincent is an overconfident type, and I'll wager he doesn't expect to be followed. So they won't go any great distance from the road before they make camp." Maddie nodded. She glanced around at the closely set trees surrounding them. There wasn't a lot of room between them, which would make it awkward for her to use the sling, her preferred weapon. She unslung her bow, selected an arrow, and knocked it to the string. Will did the same.
5 meter leap, Frog, he said. I'll go first.
Again she signalled her understanding. It was a standard ranger drill for moving through cover. Will went first, while she waited, her bow half raised, ready to draw, aim and shoot if there was any sign of danger. Then he stopped after 5 meters and readied his own bow, while Maddie slipped forward silently, passing him and moving on another 5 meters, before stopping in her turn. Once she was settled, Will moved again, leapfrogging her position and moving another 5 meters into the forest. And so they progressed through the thick growth of trees, barely visible when they were moving, almost invisible when they stopped, as their cloaks merged into the shadowy forest background. It was the sort of manoeuvre that had given the rangers their reputation for becoming invisible to other people, a skill they had practiced again and again until they had it perfected. The fourth time Will ghosted past her, he stopped and turned to look at her. When he saw he had her attention, he tapped one forefinger to his nose, then slid into cover behind a tree. Maddie sniffed experimentally and caught the faintest whiff of wood smoke. There was a fire somewhere up ahead, and in this damp woodland, it wouldn't have just happened by accident. Someone would have lit it on purpose. They were closing in on the vulture's campsite. 28. Will leaned back and peered up through the tall tree cover, looking for some sign of the sun. The light filtered down through the trees, and judging by the angle it took, it was early afternoon.
"We'll take a look at their camp," he said softly, his head close to Maddie's. "Then we'll come back here and wait for darkness."
After their successful raid the night before, it was most likely that the bandits would stay in camp this evening. There were no villages marked on the map in this direction, and if they had planned to raid another one farther along the main road, they would hardly have come all this way down the side track. They set off again, maintaining the same 5 meter leapfrog pattern. Maddie was in the lead,